Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel, the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased to have with us Professor Richard Middleton. Professor Middleton is a reader in American history at Queen's University in Belfast and the author of several books, perhaps the best known of which is The Bells of Victory. And today we are discussing his latest book, Cornwallis, Soldier and Statesman in a Revolutionary World, published by Yale University Press. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you. Thank you for the invitation to speak today to answer some of your challenging questions.
Professor, why did you write this book?
Well, a couple of reasons. I had been working on a sort of student text on the War of American Independence, which necessarily brought me into close acquaintance, or relatively close acquaintance, with Cornwallis. And it appeared to me that there wasn't any really, well, no recent or even distant. There was only one biography for Cornwallis. Of course, there had been quite a lot of attention paid to him by American writers, but I didn't feel that his story had been told necessarily from his point of view. So that was really the two reasons. Yeah, lack of an up-to-date biography, and the fact that it sort of sparked my interest. I also knew he had a career that went on from America. Indeed, he very much redeemed himself by in India, by going to India, and then various missions when he came back during the French Revolutionary War. So as I had a background in British history and I was working in Ireland, these were things that I knew I could weave or would give me perhaps some insight into those aspects of his later career.
What was Lord Cornwallis's family background?
He was the eldest son of the first Earl Cornwallis. The family could trace their roots back to the 14th century, when a Cornwallis Wally was called named Sheriff of London. And indeed, the family may have had Irish backgrounds, because the name Cornwallis occurs in the in parts of Ireland. Another supposition is that the Cornwallis was that it was from Cornwall, and the coat of arms included the chout, a particular species of bird that could be found off the Cornish coast. But I think probably the Irish connection is more convincing. Anyhow, Subsequently, the Cornwallis family began to rise slowly through the various monarchs, and the first one to be ennobled and made a lord and sit in the House of Lords was William Cornwallis, who had served Charles II during the Civil War during his exile. So He was a noble in 1660 and took his seat. And then there were several more Lords Cornwallis, slowly working their way up the sort of political and social ladder. And the Cornwallis' father was then made an earl, a step up in the peerage. And so that was Cornwallis' background. The family came from since the 17th century had been centred in Suffolk, near Bury St Edmunds, the town of Bury St Edmunds. So that was his that was his background. So he was certainly born, you could say, with the proverbial silver spoon in his mouth.
Why did Lord Cornwallis decide to become a soldier? Was it not usually the case that it was the younger sons of peers, but not peers themselves, who took up soldiering?
No, I think that's not necessarily true. The quite often the eldest sons, in fact, the eldest son tended to go into the army. The second son would go into the navy. And the next son would probably go into the church, and maybe a fourth one might become a lawyer, depending. So I think that's probably, as I say, there was flexibility. Going into the army was convenient period while the heir waited to obtain his inheritance to his father to die. So a military career, very often I think probably quite a short military career, yes, cut short. But in Cornwallis's case, he confessed to desire to become a soldier from an early age. As I say, this may have been because of some of the young heirs of his age were taking a military career. He may have been inspired by his uncle Edward, who was a major general in the British Army. So I think all these things came into play. But he later confessed to his son Lord Brougham that from an early age he had been an insatiable desire to become a soldier. And so that's what he decided to do.
And how much? So
as you can see, and his father seems to have accepted that, thereby to advance the order, start him off and purchase a commission in the prestigious Grenadier or First Foot Guards Regiment as an ensign, and that was in 1756. Sorry, you were going to say.
How much experience did Lord Cornwallis acquire in the Seven Years' War?
Yes, initially his father was keen for him to be to receive the usual education for an officer was their parents would buy, their father would buy them a commission. And then they would go straight to that regiment, and then they would learn the ropes from their senior officers. And of course, experienced non-commissioned officers would quietly, as the new young ensign or lieutenant, learn the ropes of soldiering. Now, a few of the more ambitious ones would certainly try and read some of the literature, perhaps even a bit of them. History of wars, of soldiering, particularly the classics. But in this case, I'm not quite sure why the records are rather scanty. But his father, anyhow, the decision was taken that really to become a top class soldier and a senior officer, Cornwallis's education needed something more than just at a regimental level, and so he was sent off at the beginning of 1757. This is with war already, of course, France waging, but war in Europe was yet to break out. Anyhow, he was sent to a a college, an academy, a military academy in Turin, which was very much run on the Prussian lines of military theory, military practice. And that reflected, of course, the esteem with which many Europeans viewed, yes, Frederick the Great, the King of Prussia, and his military prowess. So the Prussian school was thought to be the most more advanced than French military doctrine from the era of Louis XIV. So he goes to Turin, but his career is cut short by after 6 months his stay at studies, and he then in fact decides to, he hears at war that the British army is about to serve in Germany. This is 1758, and he decides to go and join the British forces in with Prince Ferdinand, who'd taken command of the Hanoverian and British forces trying to oppose the French and provide cover, of course, of Frederick the Great, who was now immersed in a war on three or four fronts. But in terms of his career, then Cornwallis initially was given a posting as an aide to Lord Granby, the commander of the British cavalry, and then he got a captaincy in a new foot regiment. And within 3 years, and this reflects, I think, his aristocratic background, he and the lieutenant colonel was effectively the management of a regiment. The colonel very often was just the titular head. So this was very, very remarkable progress. Yes, he did the Battle of Minden in August 1759, and as far as one can tell, he clearly caught the eye of various senior officers, so that helping to smooth his progress to his position as a lieutenant colonel. He did have to come back at one point, but his father died. Yes, his father died. He did then return to the front, but then the war was beginning to wind down at the end of 1762. That brought that stage of his... But he certainly had a lot of experience in various actions, both as a company commander and then as a regimental commander from 1761 onwards.
What was his involvement in British politics prior to 1776?
Prior to 1770, the Cornwallis family had been staunch supporters of the Whig establishment. They'd supported the Glorious Revolution in 1688-89 and had remained very firm supporters of Whig governments right through to this period when Cornwallis, with the coming of peace, Cornwallis takes his position in the House of Lords. Certainly, of course, support for the Whigs had helped the family fortunes and advances. As I say, his father had got the earldom, largely, I think, because of his political commitment to the support of the ministries of Walpole, and they added that Cornwallis and his family, his aunts was connected with the Duke of Newcastle, and there would also to the Townshend family, who were another major Whig family. So Whig, the support of the Whig cause was very, very ingrained in Cornwallis. It was natural for him. Now, of course, you may know, or your listeners may know, that in 1762-63, George III decided to, he dispensed with the services of Newcastle, who with Pitt had made up the ministry that had brought such glory on Britain, and opted to use the services of Lord Bute as Prime Minister. And the Whigs, for the first time since 1689, found themselves in opposition, opposition wasn't necessarily looked upon as being a very honourable thing to do. And nevertheless, Newcastle, trying to redeem the city or gather his supporters, began a series of dinners and whatnot, which, opposition to the ministry was the principal tonic. And Cornwallis was one of those who was invited to attend. And Cornwallis, therefore, supported the Whig opposition. And, of course, in due course, Lord Bute's ministry, or he himself, crumbled. And eventually, by 1765, quite a short time, the King George III was inviting the Whigs, now led by the Marquis of Rockingham, into office. The Rockingham Whigs came into office with the commitment to repeal the Stamp Act. Political considerations required that they nevertheless to win Parliament over. The Stamp Act had gone through the previous year with the Grenville Bute successor had passed the Stamp Act with almost no political opposition. It just went through on the nod. America wanted considerations at that point. They were concerned about the height of the debt, the taxes, and of course the consideration that a common assumption that yes, the Americans should pay a little bit of towards the cost of the empire. Cornwallis, when he came into office, naturally supported the Whigs, in the repeal of the Stamp Act. But he did go further. I was going to say that the Whigs, in order to get the Stamp Act passed, had to make a concession to the hardliners or those who thought the Stamp Act should not be repealed by passing the Declaratory Act, reaffirmation of Parliament's sovereignty to pass laws and legislation respecting America in all cases whatsoever. And Cornwallis, interestingly, he and a small number of four or five peers led by Lord Shelburne thought this was not a good Whig policy and should be, and they actually voted against the Declaratory Act in its early stages. Now, I have to say, now, because of this, historians have assumed that Cornwallis was naturally sympathetic to the American cause and remained so until he went to America to serve. I don't think that is actually true. I think he probably supported voted on the Declaratory Act because of he was very friendly with Shelburne at this time. I think that's probably the reason why he did that. Because thereafter, Cornwallis voted with the ministry on their American legislation when he was in Parliament. He showed consistently support of the ministerial measures, and that included the Massachusetts Government Act and the Act for the Restraint of New England Trade when they came up in 1774, the Intolerable Acts. So he wasn't, I think, actually sympathetic to it. Certainly not sympathetic to America. I mean, I think he'd come to the conclusion as relations worsened that really the Americans were being unreasonable and were being led by a small duplicitous minority who were taking the majority of the population away from their natural loyalty.
Why did Lord Cornwallis decide to volunteer to serve in America?
Well, I think that for that reason, that he felt the American position was unreasonable, that the ministry had lent back, it had repealed the Stamp Act, had made conciliatory gestures, but there had been a long series of incendiary incidents that it was time, along with the vast majority, I think, of really the British establishment, and I suspect to the common people, that it was time to teach America a lesson. They needed to be reined in. They were breaking up the empire. for no very good reason, and it was the work of a small minority. So yeah, when the fighting started and the decision was taken, when necessarily that reinforcements would have to be sent and additional generals, it was felt that Gage had not done his had not been firm enough and not been a very effective commander. And the decision was to send three major generals, Lord Howe, William Howe, Sir Henry Clinton, and I forget the other guy, so it's sent at the moment my memory. The decision, as Cornwallis was very keen, would have liked to have been among them. He, about this time, he was promoted to the major position of Major General, and he would like to have been among them. And he certainly volunteered his services to go. Initially they were rejected, but then when a decision was taken to send some of the reinforcements leaving the British Isles, leaving Ireland, leaving Britain, heading for America, some of those were to be sent to the south to try and stimulate southern loyalists to give them support. Cornwallis offered to take that detachment, that section of the army, American army going to America, to take them to Virginia and Carolinas, yeah. So I think it was with absolute clear conscience that he went to America. Unlike the Howes, you probably, of course, know that the Howe family, Sir William and his brother, Lord Howe, Lord Richard Howe, had American sympathies. And that, of course, was because their brother, who was originally Lord George Howe, had died in the Seven Years' War at Ticonderoga, and the people of Massachusetts had really captured a lot of Americans' hearts with those people who met him, and the people of Massachusetts had erected a statue to the Howe family that in honor of Lord Howe. So the Howe family, they did have strong sentiments. They felt the rebellion should be put down, but they were anxious for reconciliation. I don't think these considerations were, Cornwallis didn't have those sort of American connections or sympathies. He hadn't served there during the Seven Years' War.
How did Lord Cornwallis find serving under Howe? Sir William Howe, did he have any disagreements with the latter's strategy?
I don't think so. Unfortunately, the records, of course, the Howe correspondence was all, except his official correspondence with Lord George Germain, Secretary of State. There was a fire in the Howe establishment many years later, and all the personal correspondence and the Cornwallis correspondence seems to have been all the personal stuff. Pretty much all of his personal correspondence, except one or two exceptions, were also destroyed. So it's a little bit difficult to, but Cornwallis seems to have got on well with Sir William Howe, yeah. And the evidence of this is that Howe decided to take him as his second in command on the expedition to Philadelphia in 1777. I should say, I mean, this partly may have been the other side of the coin, is that Howe had a pretty much an instant dislike of Sir Henry Clinton. He found Clinton trying to press his own ideas on Howe, and Howe seemed to be, I mean, he seemed to be very much kept his thoughts to himself. I mean, the decision to go to Philadelphia, incidentally, which was very controversial, given that it was to go by sea right down to the Chesapeake and then go sail back up the Chesapeake. This decision was taken seemingly by Sir William Howe, and his brother, now the Admiral Richard Lord Howe, seemed to have been taken between. I don't think there was very much correspondence or discussion with Howe's immediate military supporters like Cornwallis. But Howe certainly didn't like Clinton, found him tedious, and decided to leave Clinton, who was actually senior to Cornwallis, leave him in New York for the 1777 campaign. But working, the two men, like Cornwallis and Howe, seemed to have got on pretty well, yeah. Cornwallis was the blue-eyed boy as far as Howe was concerned. But that didn't mean to say he took him necessarily very deeply into his confidence about the conduct of the campaign.
Why did Lord Cornwallis have an unhappy relationship with Sir Henry Clinton?
I think Cornwallis was basically was a fairly genial person. He liked to get on to with people, though he wouldn't necessarily kowtow to them. He had an ingrained sense of honesty and the need to. But he wanted to be get on with people if he could. I just think he found Clinton a difficult person to work with. But the dispute between them may have arisen out of a rather trivial episode in the preceding year, 1776. Clinton rather bitterly told Cornwallis that he'd been insulted, etc., and made an expression that he'd rather come the company as a mere captain rather than have to serve with Sir William Howe. And somehow Clinton came to the conclusion that his confidence, when he gave this expression of his anger to Cornwallis, subsequently told Howe this, Clinton claimed he would rather be a mere company commander than second in command to Sir William. And that was the reason why then Howe consigned Clinton to staying in New York while Cornwallis and Sir William went off to Philadelphia. So, and that seemed to, I don't know, undermine. But I mean, I have to say that Clinton was, and everyone says, was a very prickly character, quick to take offense and to take a slight, that he'd been to notice or think he'd been slighted or undervalued.
What was Lord Cornwallis's strategy upon being named Commander-in-Chief in South Carolina?
Well, it was set down for him by Clinton, his orders. Clinton remains, of course, his Commander-in-Chief. The orders were to continue the pacification. The assumption was with the surrender of Charleston and the mass submitting of the population, readiness to take their paroles, and the assumption was that the country would be quite rapidly pacified. And Clinton, indeed, before he left to go back to New York, dispatched Cornwallis to Camden and various other officers to the periphery, the assumption being that now South Carolina was secure. Yeah. But of course, after a few weeks, middle of July, it became clear that after Clinton had gone, Cornwallis was now in command. It became clear to Cornwallis that the activities of Sumter and Francis Marion were stirring up the country. And they were also being encouraged by the arrival of Continental forces in neighboring North Carolina. It wasn't just a matter of taking oaths of loyalty. It was clear that a new campaign would become necessary. And Cornwallis was always a man who liked to take the offensive. So since peaceful pacification, you could say, was clearly not working, and while there was a continental presence and also a lot of Virginia militia were known to be marching southwards, and the Continentals under General Horatio Gates, it was consensual to take the war to the enemy by invading North Carolina. First of all, securing the frontier of South Carolina, which he did, or hopefully thought he would achieve, at the Battle of Camden, which was a stunning victory. And then, clearly, you would have to move in to North Carolina. I think the attitude of the British, to some extent, was a little bit like that of the American in Vietnam, that you couldn't secure north south of Vietnam, unless you know you could cut off the routes through Laos and Cambodia. So you needed to advance there. This was, of course, was Nixon's strategy, perhaps let's say Johnson. And I think the British in the same way, Cornwallis and Clinton too, or certainly Cornwallis, that he needed to take the war to the enemy. And of course, as he discovered, then it was not enough just to conquer North Carolina. You'd have to go on to Virginia. And increasingly, thinking that Virginia was where the chips would fall. It was the conquest of Virginia. Would be the key to winning the war in the South and the Middle Colonies probably too.
Is that the reason why he decided to go north rather than south after the Pyrrhic victory at Guilford Courthouse?
Yeah, I think that's yes, definitely. Yeah, although there were other reasons. I mean, there were practical reasons. He felt he couldn't. He went chasing Greene. North Carolina, to the in interior of North Carolina, he was himself would be in grave danger of not being able to subsist his army, and not being able to confront the dangers that undoubtedly would envelop him. The other option was to he did ask for his commanding his senior officer in Charleston, Nesbitt Balfour, to send transports. The other option was to go take transports back to Charleston and then march back up to Camden in support of Lord Rawdon, who he'd left behind as commander in South Carolina. But the other thing that tipped the balance here was that Cornwallis had earlier requested that troops should be sent, an expedition should be sent to Virginia, to the Chesapeake, and particularly to up to the James River, to cut off supplies to the Carolinas. And Clinton, had loyally had very readily sent troops first under General Leslie. And then further detachments, one under Benedict Arnold, and a further reinforcement under Cornwallis's old friends, William Phillips, who's an engineer, an artillery officer, with whom he'd served in Germany. So the arrival of this growing force of in Virginia, which Clinton had also placed under Cornwallis's command, led him to think that, the forces were now there. If he brought his own forces from Wilmington, where he would retreated after Guilford Courthouse, he would move forward with join Fitz, and they would have a force of consequence with which to hopefully make a cut off supplies to the Carolinas and perhaps establish a new order in Virginia. So it was a combination of those things, the difficulties of getting back in time to help Rawdon and the attractions of moving northwards to join up with Phillips and conduct a decisive campaign as he saw it in Virginia.
How responsible was Lord Cornwallis for the debacle at Yorktown?
Well, I think here, his strategy for moving into Virginia was obviously very, very questionable. But on the Yorktown, I think he can be absolved. He was anticipating a war of movement of, chasing the rebels. But one thing he'd overlooked was that Virginia was much closer to New York than Charleston or the interior of North Carolina. And Clinton was now felt in a stronger position to be able to impose his own ideas on the war that Cornwallis was conducting in Virginia. And Sir Henry decided that, he had various plans. I mean, he himself was thinking of possibly going to Virginia at one point to conduct expeditions at the top end of the Chesapeake area, the area around Baltimore, and into even into southern Pennsylvania. He'd been advised by a Colonel William Rankin that there was a great deal of loyalist support in that region. So this was one reason why Clinton had been funneling more troops down into the Chesapeake. Then, of course, Clinton then learned about the Wethersfield conference between Washington and the Rochambeau, Count Rochambeau, the French troops who'd been arrived in Rhode Island in 1780, and they'd been sort of sitting there waiting for action. Clearly, Clinton saw there was a threat developing to New York, so he abandoned the ideas initially of a further campaigning in Virginia. But he then suggested to Cornwallis that he must provide a base or find a base for his troops, and then he expanded this enlarged the mission that not only a base for the troops, but also a base for the Navy, and particularly for the Navy's large battleships, the line of battleships. Now, Clinton took this decision. Again, this is to some extent, when you look at Clinton, he has many worthy aspects to his character. He was technically a very competent soldier, but he did carry on. I mean, he was a very critical of Cornwallis for coming up from abandoning South Carolina, the Carolinas, and coming to Virginia. But he was also bitterly opposed to the Admiral Marriott Arbuthnot, who commanded the British fleet in North America. And Clinton demanded that Arbuthnot would be recalled and a replacement. And the ministry did this, and Clinton was so grateful that the new Rear Admiral Gray, Thomas Graves, was happy to facilitate the Navy, because the Navy itself didn't like New York as its principal base. The sandbanks over the entrance to New York Harbor damaged the ships, or the keels of big ships. New York was also likely to in danger of freezing over, and had been a very, very serious freezing of the Hudson, the lower reach of the Hudson, and the area around the harbor, such to an extent that it was said that the weight of cannons could be borne by the ice, which made any ship, of course, trapped there very vulnerable to attack by enemy forces. So the Navy wanted an ice-free port, and an easily accessible place where they could at least anchor their ships, and particularly the West Indian fleet, when it needed to come northwards or go anywhere elsewhere to escape the hurricane season. So all these things came down, and Clinton was more than ready to gratify the Navy. So he then sent the instructions to Cornwallis. His mission was therefore what he was now just to concentrate on building this new facility at a place that Cornwallis wasn't clear quite where would be the most suitable. Cornwallis was very much against this. He appreciated a fixed base like that might be quite vulnerable to attack. Building and constructing a large base at Yorktown was not his idea of the war, and in fact requested Clinton permission to return to the Carolinas to take command there again once again. Clinton rejected that and insisted that Cornwallis work on the concentrate on the construction of the new naval facility and military facility.
Why was Lord Cornwallis greeted so warmly upon his return to England?
I think he just captured the public imagination, and that he was someone. I mean, it is in some ways a little bit surprising. But sometimes, you know, in defeat, people defiantly cling to their leaders. And Cornwallis had caught the eye of the public, his previous campaigns, the big victory at Camden, and his chase after someone who hadn't been just sitting in New York, as Clinton often appears to be doing nothing, consuming large quantities of provisions and costing the country huge quantities. Cornwallis was someone who'd got out there and tried to find the enemy and bring the war to a decisive fight, the decisive battle against the Washington or Green or whoever. The other thing I think was also would filter back the troops. See, he was known for his he was someone who attracted the troops. He always suffered their own deprivation. He didn't pamper himself when the decision was taken to advance into North Carolina to destroy all the unnecessary equipment. Cornwallis set the lead in burning his own, trinkets or his camp equipment that he would normally carry, which would be too heavy to carry with a much slimmed down, almost without any wagon train. So he was someone had a sort of appeal to the soldiers, recognized their travails, didn't ostentatiously seek his own comfort or ease. And I think all that probably would filter back that, he was the commander the people took to their hearts, rightly or wrongly.
Why was he offered the position of commander-in-chief and governor-general of Bengal?
Yeah, there are a number of factors here. The first was that the British government were unhappy at the way affairs had developed in India. Partly it may have been envy, the huge wealth that people like Robert Clive had accumulated, the so-called nabobs who had made these vast fortunes, came back buying up large tracts of land, buying their way into parliament, into parliamentary seats, etc. That, I think, grated on a lot of people. But I think there was also recognition that, it was also the company, despite the huge wealth, the seeming wealth of India, the company was losing money, yes, because of all the profits, all the way was being creamed off. I think there was also a new sense that growing the age of enlightenment, that governments shouldn't be just about exploitation and holding office and privilege and everything else. There was a sense that government ought to offer the common people just a little bit more than what they perhaps had been. Because even the despots of Europe, a point I'm making in the book, the despots of Europe like to describe themselves as benevolent despotism. They were firm authoritative rule, but it had a strong commitment to improving the lot of the common people. So I think that's all feeding through. The choice of Cornwallis, well, as I say, he came back almost a hero from his American venture. He quickly was clearly respected. It was known that he'd taken a stand against army profiteering, which was something that was coming to profiteering generally. So he had this reputation, and the previous governor of Bengal, Governor General, the first Governor General, so-called, of Bengal, Warren Hastings, had infinite problems in controlling his council. So he thought that Cornwallis would have the necessary status as an aristocrat, and authority as a soldier, because he recognized too the Indian army needed attention, needed reform. So I think all these things fed into the appointment of Cornwallis to the Indian job.
Now, how successful was Lord Cornwallis in implementing the reform program as mandated by the government in London?
Well, I think you would have to say he was fairly successful, well, pretty successful, would have been considered pretty successful. A huge amount of waste and corruption was cut out. Cornwallis, as he was mandated to do by the company, and indeed by an act of parliament, instead of company officials taking fees, etc., and all kinds of extortion and practices, and he insisted or brought for the new edict, which he rigorously enforced, was that people should be paid fixed salaries. But he also, as he got into the job, so that was one thing. People would not be taking kickbacks, bribes, or anything else. They had a fixed salary, and he followed this up with a very rigorous assessment. With he and his principal counselors into the functions of all the different departments and the officials in those departments to try and to establish the principles. Was the office, did it have a useful function, and or could it be cut out? Did it need expanding? But it had to have a utility to the for its existence. And an appropriate recompense for the holder of that office. So this, I think, made the company very much more effective and efficient. One of the things is, yes, Cornwallis, I mean, one of his great principal tasks was to make the company once again profitable. He succeeded in that, yes, by cutting out much of this waste and corruption and the way resources were being filched away and private trading by company employees. All that was cracked down and prevented. He succeeded in balancing the books, and the company returned to a modest profit, not a great profit, but he did bring it back into Now, as part of that remit, apart from cutting out waste and corruption, he was instructed to try and make a new land settlement or a permanent settlement with the landowning classes of the Indian population to fix fair rates for the rent or the taxes levied on their properties. He successfully, he managed to implement, this is the so-called permanent settlement. The argument was, and Cornwallis was very enthusiastic about this, was that whereas under previous or Indian governments, the levies extracted from the landowners could be, all from one year to another, they would be all different levels and different exactions. They never knew where they would stand. The argument about the permanent settlement was that this would give the landowning classes clarity, that they knew what they would in fact have a fixed permanent assessment. They would then be able to work to that. They could, anything over and above that would be their profit and theirs alone. The government wouldn't come after them for additional taxes. And added to this was also the sense, the feeling that another advantage of a permanent settlement would help the local population, establish and give them security in their property and their everything. But it would also help develop what Cornwallis sees as a very desirable thing of a more elevated or more enlightened aristocracy, rather like the English. You'd see it as the English aristocracy, an aristocracy that would be or governing elite that would be enlightened self-interest, would be driven by those sort of considerations, that self-improvement of their lands, better treatment of their of the peasants, the riots, the Indian agricultural laborers or peasant class. They would also benefit from this. And he was looking at it in a way to the English aristocracy, people like his great uncle Lord Townshend, known as Turnip Townshend, who was carried out in agricultural reforms in Britain that stimulated production and increase the wealth of the agriculture, the agrarian classes, and generally the wealth of the country. The permanent settlement, however, well, it didn't lead to an enlightened, as historians have all constantly pointed out, it didn't lead to an enlightened aristocracy. And sadly, yes, it didn't lead to the kind of improvements that he anticipated, he and the company and the ministry anticipated. It didn't bring the improvements to agriculture that it was anticipated that it would do. So that was less of an achievement, I think. The third part of his initial instructions was to attend to complaints from the population about the previous exploitation or expropriation of their lands by the company, by company officials. And Cornwallis used that directive to look into the whole of the civil laws by which the company governed India, establishing new courts rather on the British model of magistrates' courts and then superior courts for dealing with appeals. I think that was a considerable considerable improvement.
Why was Lord Cornwallis named Lord Lieutenant of Ireland?
Well, he'd come back to England. He was appointed into the cabinet and played a very leading role. As a minister, initially he was there to advise, partly to advise the cabinet on military matters. Also as Master General of the Ordnance, which was his formal position. I mean, effectively, he was Minister of War Production. But then, of course, Ireland had not a very satisfactory position there. What you had was an elite, the sort of Anglo-Irish elite, which were only rested their support really was no more than about 10% of the population, excluding the 75% of the Catholic population and the 15% of the population who were Presbyterians in their religious practices. And the onset of the French Revolution created really quite a cocktail of unrest. The landlord class. I mean, these were quite opposite again from Cornwallis's view about the British aristocracy being itself an enlightenment. The landlord owning classes in Ireland, they exacted high rates, levy or rents on the tenantry. And the church, the Anglican Church, also the elites. Supported the elite, of which the elite were members. They levied, of course, church tithes. The very, very mixture, and then, of course, the appeal began to be of the French Revolution, offering a way to more, at least among the intelligentsia, particularly Presbyterians, that revolution, republican ideas begin to gain ground. And as I say, the mass of the peasantry, the exaction of the tithes and the high rents, which bedeviled Ireland, create a very, very volatile situation. So a rebellion breaks out in 1798, led by Wolfe Tone and other leading Republicans. With the idea, yes, of expelling the British and establishing a French-style republic. And in this situation, the current Lord Lieutenant, the Lord Camden, feels completely inadequate. And he had for some time been pleading for Cornwallis to be sent over to sort the situation out. With the outbreak of the serious rebellion in late May, 1798 rebellion, Pitt decides, yes, Cornwallis is the man to rescue the situation, but not simply to pacify the country. the British political classes for a long time had decided, yes, Ireland was rotten to the core. The existing Anglo-Irish elite were completely incapable of rescuing the situation. So Cornwallis has a double mission, yes, pacify the country, but also enact help with the enactment of an act of union, bringing legislative union to the two kingdoms. So Ireland would become part of Great Britain.
Now, did Lord Cornwallis believe in Catholic emancipation as a remedy for the discontent of Ireland, or I should say discontent of Ireland's Catholics?
Yes, he did. This is one of the things that surprised me, that just how insistent he was right from the start that Catholic emancipation was really a sine qua non for a successful pacification of the country and certainly for a successful act of union. This is one of the areas where his lack of personal papers and personal correspondence or keeping of a diary, one feels quite sadly that this prevented me from getting absolutely to the bottom of why he was so vociferously pro-Catholic or Catholic emancipation. He was in his religious views, of course, he was a member of the Church of England, but he's very much the sort of latitudinarian style. The 39 Articles of the Anglican Church, of course, can cater for just about every kind of different religious doctrine, ideology possible. And he very much thought religion was, in the end, was a matter for the individual, providing they maintained, observed the king's peace. Their religion, I suppose. So he is really quite very much liberal in terms of of the church on that, and I think that makes him much more than sympathetic or ready to accommodate the Catholics. I do think also he never said this. I haven't seen this in writing, but his experience from America, you couldn't win a war, you couldn't regain a country to its loyalty. If the mass of the population had been alienated and try to meet their concerns, you couldn't govern without at least the passive consent of the majority of the population, and clearly that wasn't the case in Ireland. So Catholic emancipation was a sine qua non, was essential. And he pursues that all the way through. Some of the cabinet, Pitt wavers and says yes and then no. There's a very strong support for within Pitt's cabinet for the Anglo-Irish elite, who are absolutely, totally opposed to Catholic emancipation. Winning over the cabinet was very difficult, but it did seem towards the start of 1801 and the Act of Union has been passed that Catholic emancipation would follow. And then to Cornwallis's bitter regret, it didn't. And he several times made the prediction that if emancipation wasn't granted, then inevitably in due course at some point it would be taken or demanded or and wrested from Britain. Britain would have to concede emancipation, and there would be this kind of ratchet effect that would lead to further demands. And of course, this is precisely what the history of the 19th century Ireland shows, that demands a reawakening sense of Catholic Irish and national identity, increasingly demands to undo the Act of Union. So I think he here was extremely foresighted in what, if they didn't grant it then as a gift, they will be forced from them later in due course.
Why did the Addington cabinet name Lord Cornwallis as its chief negotiator with the French, and how good a negotiator was he?
The reasons for his appointment, I suppose he personally had quite good relations with at least with Addington. I suppose he was his prestige was running fairly high, and his achievements in, as it was seen in India, in restoring or strengthening the British Empire, and his success seemingly, in, of course, in Ireland, again, in bringing Ireland into the British, into the Britain, as part of Britain, as this part of the centre of the imperial, of a new set, beginning of the, perhaps a new set, a little bit of an imperial mission. I think all these things, made him preeminently, someone who could hopefully would stand up to Napoleon, because the negotiations obviously would be at some point anyhow would be with Napoleon, and it was hoped that Cornwallis's own reputation as a Governor General of Bengal, of India, people increasingly referring to. He was a sort of proconsular figure. He spoke reasonably good French. He'd be able to conduct the negotiations. Having said that, of course, Cornwallis's mission was simply to preliminaries treaty. The articles of peace had been already drafted, had been agreed in London. And it really was only, it seemed to be one or two small points that Cornwallis would have to cross the I's and dot the T on the final treaty. All the hard work had been done by the diplomats. So that's the reason, I think, he would be a formality, and the signing would go ahead. of course, didn't quite work out like that, because there were some things that happened that the I's hadn't been dotted or the T's crossed, particularly on the issue of Malta. And also perhaps the British were naive in thinking that on their side the things would go through smoothly. In fact, I think it's well documented now that the French Napoleon didn't necessarily see the preliminaries as anything other than a sort of they were ready to undo or reinterpret or change their stance on a number of issues, also including the there were costs of payment for the supporting the ministers, prisoners, which the British had been largely paying for. There were issues like that. In the end, the British weighed the but the overall the discussions, in fact, particularly over Malta, go backwards and forwards, and appear to be going nowhere. As I say, I think the main reason was because the French were still trying to wrest some extra advantage before they did their final signature. Now, Cornwallis himself, he was sometimes baffled by these manoeuvres. He did have one or two experienced diplomats with him to advise him on all matters relating Francis Merry, who was a very able diplomat. Not a very merry person in his personality, as Cornwallis noted at one point, but a very efficient and effective, and he paid great tribute to Merry's support at critical moments. In the end, Cornwallis, the French realized they weren't making any advances or undoing any of the articles, and eventually they recognized them, or more or less signed what had been agreed in London in the preliminary articles. Well, very, very few, only very minor changes. So although Cornwallis, many people criticized, because the British press were not impressed by Cornwallis. Well, they assumed that Britain would gain a lot more. It appeared that Britain appeared to have surrendered much more than the French had, that particularly capture of three or four of the French West Indian islands, they were returned to the French, and Britain seemed to get very, very little out of that. But that wasn't Cornwallis's fault. That was had been agreed by the British ministry. You were very, Addington minister wanted peace. They wanted to restore the British finances, the borrowing, the debt problems and whatnot. They wanted peace, and they had agreed to the preliminaries, and that's pretty much what Cornwallis delivered. But certainly there was a lot of criticism, and people thought that Britain should have had a lot more, and a lot of them blamed Cornwallis that he wasn't up to the job.
How do we evaluate Lord Cornwallis today? Still the heroic proconsul of empire?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult one. I think he's unfairly been rather written out of the various parts of the, at least in British history. His achievements in India, however questionable. And of course, there are a lot of questions to be raised about Cornwallis in India. But just before I could deal with that, a few comments on that. Elsewhere, yeah, I think in Ireland, his achievements have been really downplayed. The achievement of the Act of Union. If there is still credit going there, it's given to Castlereagh, who Cornwallis acknowledged was a very, very effective colleague, and to William Pitt. So I think he's been somewhat written out of that. Of course, in dealing with the empire, with India, there are all these questions about, now we're saying, this is, empire is a very dirty, pejorative term. And anyone involved in imperialistic adventures or must be is to be cannot be a good person. So I think the point I would make about Cornwallis, yes, okay, maybe the British Empire and the round was it was a thing of its time, and it had to come to an end, and did come to an end, rightly so. And there were many periods in its history when it suffered. It was very much a system that was only largely advantage, of course, of the governing class, the imperial power, and was exploitative as far as the mass of the Indian population were concerned. But so far as Cornwallis, I think he did have, it was a remarkable point that I would make, is he was a remarkable humanitarian. His respect for other people, other religions, his dislike, for instance, he was quite progressive on it, and he disliked slavery. He didn't campaign against slavery, but he did consider at one point that slavery in India ought to be tackled at some point, although of course it was such a huge undertaking, it was beyond his remit and beyond his power. But he is very rather progressive and very, very humanitarian. His concern for his common soldiers, I think all these things made him and he had a vision that the empire would be could be a beneficial, a humanitarian one, in which all the different sections of the population had their place, but it was a place in which, for instance, Indians, their properties were protected, and their lives were protected by known laws. Because one of the things I didn't get mentioned was his so-called Cornwallis Code, where he decided to bring up a whole list of codes dealing with all aspects of government and the laws, explaining, and had these printed, and he believed in transparency, the importance of having these things, so that the ordinary Indians or they could understand their place in society. So I think he had the notion that it was a complementary and could be a benefit to the governing and the governed. Of course, you could say it's a little bit rather naive, and it's a bit like what defenders of slavery in America said. You know, there was a place for the slaves; they were not capable of being looking after themselves, but the slave system gave them security. Of course, as we know, this was delusional thinking.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. Thank you, Professor.
Well, thank you very much. A pleasure to be able to address your audience. Thank you.